Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. I am traveling a lot. Today on the show, I talked to Chris Pine. I don't know. It's just every time I see him, I'm like, I like that guy. I like, especially in that Hell or High Water movie. I think he's good. He's got something, that guy Pine. And sometimes I just have to like a guy, and then I'll have him on the show. And it turns out he's a pretty likable guy. He's been in those new Star Trek movies, Wonder Woman, Unstoppable. His new movie, which he co-wrote, directed, and stars in, is called Pool Man, which is a weird little movie, a weird little comedy with some big stars. He plays a guy that you wouldn't expect him to play. It was pretty good, but he's here. I talked to him. But let's talk about other things. How's it going with you? What are you doing? What are you obsessed with? What are you obsessed with? I go through these things where, like, it could be anything. It doesn't have to be, you know, I've gone through it with music. I've gone through it with guitars. I've gone through it with pieces of wood. I don't know. I've gone through it with lavender plants, which are beginning to disappoint me out front. I don't think I got the right kind of lavender. That's how I ground myself, folks. That is what I do. I get obsessed with something seemingly ridiculous for as long as it takes me to calm down, whether that be days, weeks, or months, or years. Some obsessions last longer than others. And usually when you're done with the obsession, you have a lot of whatever it is you were obsessed with around. And then you start saying things like, man, I got to get rid of some stuff. But you don't. You don't do it. Lately, the obsession has been these, I don't even know who told me about it, but this East Fork pottery. East Fork mugs. Like, I'm a mug guy. And, you know, you kind of spend a lifetime. You kind of spend a lifetime trying to find a mug. Sometimes you get very committed to a mug. I got the Brian Jones mugs. But they're fancy. East Fork, the East Fork pottery stuff, I think it's out of... maybe North Carolina. They are in Asheville, North Carolina, which is, you know, pottery haven. But somebody hit me to the East Fork mugs. And then, like, I just had to have all the other East Fork stuff. And that's been the obsession. And I got the mugs in, like, every different color. They've got all these tiny little bowls that you can use, like, while you're cooking for putting spices in. They got big bowls. They got plates. They got serving bowls, and they got all these colors. Like, when I first started living like an adult, I was kind of obsessed with Heath pottery. But you all know I'm a pottery guy, but this is stuff you can, you know, you buy plates and stuff. It's not just pieces, a vase or something like that, or something fancy. It's like practical stuff. So I had all this Heath stuff, the basic blue Heath stuff. And then, like, somebody told me about these East Fork mugs, and they're like the best. And they're weighted properly. They look cool. I don't know. So that's what's happening. I think I'm going to end up with several houses worth of East Fork pottery. I think go look at it. Go. It's at eastfork.com. I'm not trying to get a deal here. I'm just telling you what I'm working on obsession-wise, and that seems to be it. My dates. I've got a few dates coming up. And by the way, I am sorry about the cancellations or the reschedules of many of the dates later in the summer and early fall. If it happened to you, I will come back. I am rescheduling those. I hope you can make it. But I'm doing a TV thing, and I had to do the TV thing. I want to do the TV thing. It may be the last TV thing I do. This week, I'll be in Munhall, Pennsylvania, outside Pittsburgh on May 9th at the Carnegie Library Music Hall. Cleveland, Ohio on May 10th at Playhouse Square. In Detroit, Michigan on May 11th at the Royal Oak Music Theater. I'm back at Largo in L.A. on Tuesday, May 14th. Here are the rescheduled dates. And again, I'm sorry. Santa Barbara, California at the Libero Theater. That will now be on January 30th, 2025. San Luis Obispo, California at the Fremont Theater. That's now January 31st. Monterey, California at the Golden State Theater, February 1st. Iowa City at the Englert Theater on February 13th. Des Moines at Hoyt Sherman Place. That's Des Moines, Iowa, February 14th. Kansas City, Missouri at the Midland Theater, February 15th. Asheville, North Carolina at the Orange Peel, February 20th. Nashville, Tennessee at the Polk Theater, February 21st. Louisville, Kentucky at the Kentucky Center for the Performing Arts, February 2nd. Lexington, Kentucky at the Lexington Opera House, February 23rd. Durham, North Carolina at the Carolina Theater, March 21st. Charlotte, North Carolina at the Knight Theater, March 22nd. Charleston, South Carolina at the Charleston Music Hall, March 23rd. For all ticket links, go to WTFpod.com/tour. I'm sorry I had to reschedule, but I had to do it. And who knows what's going to happen in November. You know, I hope I can make all these dates and we're not a divided country to the point where I have to, there are border crossings from state to state. We'll see. I guess we'll adapt or we'll run or we'll fight. But that one seems to be the least possible. So what's happening? So I did some shows. I flew into New York. I did three shows. Montclair, New Jersey. Philly, outside of Philly. Glenside, is that what it's called? The Keswick. And then D.C. at the Warner, which was spectacular. I had this amazing comic open for me, Maddie Wiener, who I never worked with before. And all I'm hoping is that I get along with the opener so we can drive for hours and chit-chat and not be weird or awkward. And it was great. It was great to talk about comedy. And it's weird. I don't know where I stand with anybody with comics. I don't have... my inner dialogue is not great, but it was kind of nice. She and some other comics of her generation seemed to, you know, have me in pretty high esteem. She knew a lot of my old bits, and it was nice. I think that's one of the great honors and rewards of this business. It's not so much that it is also. I'm very happy I have an audience and grateful that you come out and you're all decent, grown-up people. But, you know, when other comics respect you and they kind of know what you do and you're one of their guys, it feels like the best. And she was amazing. I kind of had a minor meltdown in New York, and it all kind of brought some things into clarity for me. As you know, because you listen to this show and you know what I'm thinking and where I'm at, there was a period there where I was going to move to New York. I was very close to moving to New York. And I thought, like, New York, in my mind, was a place where I could get old. I thought, wouldn't it be great to be an old New York guy? I could be an old guy living in New York, doing things, engaged in the world, feeding on the electricity that is that city, and doing high culture things. Even though I didn't do that stuff when I was younger living in New York, I thought, like, I will be an engaged New York old man. And then, like, I kind of pulled back from that for reasons that are supported by this experience. But I kind of pulled back from that because I realized it's a young man's game. Maybe if I was in my 30s or 40s and I was bicoastal, that was sort of the dream. But now I'm 60 and I started to rethink it. And I thought maybe I wanted something different for my life. I wanted something more peaceful, maybe New Mexico. But I'll tell you, man, I was in New York and I was an embarrassing experience where I realized I made the right decision because I saw clearly what kind of New York old man I would be. And it wasn't pretty and I wasn't proud. And I had to apologize twice. And I just had not seen this part of myself in a while. And I flew into New York. I was staying at the Ludlow, which is where I usually stay. And they put me my manager got upgraded to a suite, and this exact thing happened to me the last time I went to the Ludlow. The suite is it's not good. It's on the fourth floor. It's facing the street. It's got a room up in the front, which is not good for much, unless maybe I was recording an interview, but even then the other rooms are better. So I tried to go to sweep, and there was construction at 1:30 in the morning. 1:30 in the morning, there was construction. Now, look, I know New York, what am I complaining about? It's what happens. But it felt like it was in my room. And then the next morning, I woke up to the sound of this like loud ass truck across the street. It was a truck that had a tank on it that was running a tube, a hose into Katz's. I don't know if it was draining or filling up grease. I don't know what it was doing, but it was 6:30 in the morning. So now I'm on 5 hours of sleep. I go down to the counter. I'm like, I can't. What is with that room? How is that room a good room? How is that a suite that anybody would want? I can't. I couldn't sleep at all. The fucking noise. I'm at this pitch and I'm upset. And I knew what I was doing it. That guy inside of me was like, dude, keep it together. But I'm like, I can't. I'm at the end of my rope here. I need another room. And they're like, okay, fine, we'll find you another room. And then the next day, I was going to get another room. And they said, all right, we'll put you in another room, but we don't know when it's going to be done. So I had to check out of the suite at noon. And then, like, I go up and they said, well, your room's clean. I'm like, great, can I go in? No, we got to get it inspected. I'm like, well, how long is that going to take? Well, we put you on queue. I mean, how many times do I got to stay here before you can just call somebody who has to inspect the room and say, go have a look. We got this guy, he stays here a lot. So I was pulling rank. I was being a bit of a diva. And I was being difficult. And I was mad. And I felt bad about it because I was mad and it was visible. And there are strangers there. I don't think anyone, had a phone out. It wasn't that bad. But so I sat there in the fucking lobby, in the bar area, kind of angry, pouty, making plans, ready to switch hotels, dramatic. And then the manager, this nice young woman, comes up to me and she goes, we have your room, Mr. Marin. And I'm like, okay, great. And then she said, can I talk to you privately for a minute? And I'm like, okay. And we walk into the back patio area and she goes, I can't have you yelling at the counter. Okay. I'm glad we can help you out, but I can't have that. And I said, okay, I'm sorry. And she was right. And I respected her boundaries and her decision to talk to me as customer service to say, you can't do that. You can't, you just like, what are you doing? You're a grown fucking man. I'm reading into it now. But I felt bad and I was embarrassed and I said I was sorry. And she gave me the key to my new room and I went up to it. It was on the 11th floor, still facing the street, but apparently there was construction behind it. And I walk into this room, still kind of steamed, but embarrassed and contrite. And there was a baby playpen in the room. And I laughed out loud. I laughed out loud in my room at the little baby playpen that was in my room. And I just hoped in my heart that they had done that on purpose. Yeah, I went down because I was leaving and I apologized again. And it's fucked up. Look, if you generate shame from within based on things that your brain's putting you through, that's one thing. But when you put something out in the world that is embarrassing and you feel ashamed of, and you can't put it back in, you've released it. You've released it into the world. So then, I get into this sort of like, I'm sorry, anytime I walk by the people I was angry, in front of, I was like, is there, you guys need coffee, But I had to go down there, and I had to tell them, look, there's a playpen in my room for a baby. And I said, and look, you don't have to tell me, but I really hope you guys did that on purpose. I really hope that was a message because you're right. I was being a fucking baby. And they're like, no, of course we wouldn't do that. But I still hope they did that on purpose. But that story about losing my shit at the hotel was not even the story that landed the reality of who I'd be in New York in my guts. I had a day in New York. I got a little exercise in. And then I thought I'd stop at the Whole Foods to put together some sort of healthy breakfast snack for myself. So I bought some yogurt. I bought some blueberries. bought a few walnuts, and I was going to, it was early, and I was going to like steal a little bowl from the salad bar at Whole Foods, but they hadn't got it set up yet. So I went into the coffee shop that's connected to the Whole Foods there in New York. I bought a cup of coffee. It's like $4. Tipped the woman, the barista, $1. And then, you know, I had a plan. You know, I was going to mix my yogurt with my nuts and my berries. And I had a plan, man. It was in my head. I visualized it. I was trying to manifest it. So I said, do you have a cup? Can I get an extra cup? And the barista said, yeah, that'll be 50 cents if you pay cash and $1 if you charge it. And I'm like, I just want an extra cup. And she's like, yeah, it's $1. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? I mean, I just tipped you $1. I mean, what the fuck? I mean, for a cup, you're going to charge me for a cup? I'm having coffee here. I tipped you. And then I just kind of like, I was flying off the handle again. This is a fucking ridiculous. Fucking ridiculous. And I can afford 50 cents or $1 for a cup. What was I even doing? I was just like losing it all over the place. And then I just sat there like a fucking baby and was like facing them at the counter, like eating my yogurt and nuts and berries separately. Like, look what you made me do. And I thought I was winning. I thought that I was making a statement. And then I was like, my God, man, what the fuck is wrong with you? What is wrong with you? And then it was, I realized that I had hit a wall. I had hit a wall with, well, not just lack of sleep, but with New York in a way. It's just too much. And then I realized it was very clear to me, if I lived in New York, I'd just be one of those weird old men that you see kind of hunched over and grumbling and kind of like stumbly walking down the street with a Strand book bag and like two plastic Duane Reade bags filled with more plastic Duane Reade bags and orthopedic shoes, talking to myself. You know, that's who I'd be. One of those people that kind of falls through the cracks in New York. You see them and you're like, how long have they been here? But that's who I would be, wandering around. You know? I don't know, man. But those are the embarrassing stories. I guess they could be worse. I did apologize. I don't know that I apologized at the coffee shop. I'll have to make an amends when I go back. Okay, look. Time for Chris Pine. His new movie, Pool Man, comes out in theaters this Friday, May 10th. It's an odd, quirky movie. I talked to him about it and other things. So this is me and Chris Pine.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
What do you got?
Ed Begley Jr.
Yeah, he wrote a book.
What a fucking...
You know that guy?
What a stud. Well, I mean, as an LAite... He's an OG LAite who's been doing the thing. Well, no, specifically the environmental thing for a minute, like before it was ever really cool.
Yeah, he's been doing that, but he's also been around since the beginning of cool Hollywood, and his dad was old Hollywood,
100%.
And he's got stories. I mean,
great stories.
Well, yeah, because it was such a smaller town then.
Yeah.
And it was a community. So like when he was running around in the 70s, you know, he's at Dantana's, he's out at the Manson Ranch. He's just, there's shit.
How old is he? My father was here in LA the same time. And yeah. He came out in 64. And
I think Begley's in his 70s. Like
he's around that same time.
Your dad came out in 64?
He came out in 64.
From where?
From Scarsdale, New York.
Oh.
Well, no. Well, he grew up in Scarsdale. Went to this college called Ohio Wesleyan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then did summer stock out in Nantucket or something. And then came out to LA in 64 and was under contract at Universal which I think had the last contract system in the, in the town.
Was he with Cranston's dad? You know, Bryan Cranston's
dad was, I had no idea.
Was a studio actor. I don't know where he was.
I have to ask my dad about it.
Yeah, I wonder, man. I wonder.
Well, I mean, Cranston is in his 60s?
Right, I guess
so. His father probably, well, I don't know. Could have been, I know, my father's 83 now.
Oh, really? How's he doing?
He is fucking doing fantastically.
He's got his, he's got all his wits about him.
He does. He has his wits about him, and God, knock on wood, he's healthy and spry and cute as can be.
Here we go. Joseph Cranston. Career. Television actor on several programs, including Space Patrol and Dragnet. So it doesn't sound like he was a studio guy.
When was he born?
1924, age 90.
Yeah, I mean, he's 24, 34. He's like 15, 16 years older than my pop.
But it's weird because, you know, Cranston, and I don't know if you're the same way because of how you grew up, like Cranston's got this very kind of working class
100%
idea of what acting is.
100%. I get such a kick out of the Nepo baby thing.
Yeah. Well, that
pisses me off. My family has such a laugh about it as if
that's
people are like, you have to hire Robert Pine's son. I mean, that stuff, I'm sure.
You know, Robert Pine from Chips. The kid's got it coming.
I'm sure that happens maybe in some, oh my God, that poster's going to drive me nuts. You're like an 8 centimeter off.
Oh, what do you mean? Oh, on in the angle?
Yeah.
We'll fix it later.
Okay.
Do I need to fix it now?
No,
what
fine.
Time's the eclipse?
The eclipse is now, pal.
It's now?
The eclipse starts at 11.
Okay.
Peaks at 11:12 apparently. It'll still be going at 12 something, but we're in the booth. I think this is
the middle. Do you have your glasses?
No, I left them inside.
What do you mean? We should go. Let's pause this and just go look at it real quick. Don't you think?
I mean, I would like to.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, that was an exciting,
super fun. What we gathered from that is that it's not a particularly
you don't have to
long
you don't have to
watch.
You don't have to linger. It's one and done
well,
with the eclipse.
They're doing their thing.
It's cool. Glad I had these glasses. Somebody who worked for what's that guy's name? Nye, you know, the science guy.
Yeah, Bill Nye.
Bill Nye's one of his people gave me those glasses.
I think we should also tell the audience that you have looked at an eclipse before.
Just for a second.
Glasses.
Just for a second. I didn't trumpet.
And it quote unquote fucked me up.
Yeah,
and I told Mark, well, if you look at the sun without sunglasses or protection, that probably is going to happen.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I guess it's an innate stubbornness where you're just sort of like, well, how bad could it be? Bad.
Yeah. Get a burn hole in your fucking eyeball. Yeah.
Fuck me up. So we're talking about your dad. Well, the Nepo baby thing for me has always been like, why do people get upset? There's like a million sort of plumbers and sons, Bill and Sons plumbers,
right.
Bill and Sons, you know, contract. It's like nepotism is just sort of like, why wouldn't you step into the thing you grew up with in the house?
No, I don't think it's that. Of course. Well, that makes a lot of sense. It's because it's like, you know, what you talked about at the dinner table. I think it's this idea that people are going to give you jobs because you're.
But the agents that were around that knew your dad or probably worked with your dad.
This is what I will say. It definitely gave, like, I got an audition very, very early on for the Gilmore Girls.
Yeah.
The Gilmore Girls, my father was in an audition
that
he didn't book, but the casting directors loved him and they loved the casters. He said, my son's an actor and he just is coming back from Williamstown, this theater festival back east. Will you see him? And they said, sure. I came in. Audition, I didn't get the part. So I got a leg in got an audition, but
sure.
You got to show your chops.
But what?
You were saying about the blue collar acting thing, which I think is totally true.
Oh,
You know, my father has had great success, and he's had periods where he hasn't worked. He's had money. He hasn't had money. He's an auditioning actor. He's not an. You know, he's been doing it since 64. So
Wow.
Yeah. So that I would definitely say I hold that probably in common with Brian.
I never locked in to. To the. You know, I did comedy all my life, and the idea was maybe I'd act. But every time I did an audition, I'm like, I can't. I'm not this guy. I can't do it.
You're not the audition guy?
No, a lot of times, like I don't love the material necessarily. When you write your own material, now you know that because you wrote a movie. which I watched last night. It was a fun, odd movie.
I appreciate, and maybe that's the best compliment I'll be able to get from that. But I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
What? I mean, isn't that what it was supposed to be?
No, I appreciate that's it. It's, you know, it's interesting. I was listening last night to the, your interview with your girlfriend who passed.
Oh, yeah, Lynn, yeah.
And Lynn said something like, you know, this first movie of mine, I gave myself permission to make something that was wholly my own.
Yeah.
And that didn't need to, like,
yeah,
please anyone. And that, I would say, definitely holds true to for a lot of my film.
Right, but when you write your own shit, I mean, you kind of have this control that when you audition for, like, especially TV, and I imagine early on, you're like, oh, my God. You just joke to joke, weird, dumb things. And
it, yeah, but I actually, there was a part when I was auditioning, I liked the competitive aspect of it. Like, I like going into an audition room.
Oh, my God.
And getting into full gladiator mode. Like, I'm going to go in and I'm going to get this part.
Oh, yeah.
So even trying to make sense out of shitty material, it's like you still have a job to do to try to make something work. So I actually like the, and I really like the flow state of it. Like, I'm very focused on one thing, no matter the level of the material or not.
Yeah.
It's like, you got to win the room. How are you going to win the room?
Oh, really?
So I actually kind of enjoy it.
Oh, so that's like diametrically opposite to me. I walk in, I see guys I've seen on television. I'm like, I'm going to go. There's no fucking way. That guy's the right guy.
It's funny speaking about my father's, because I went on an audition with my father, and he's been seeing the same guy. He's 83. He's been seeing the same guys in audition rooms for 50 plus years. They know, and they only know each other really from the audition room.
Yeah.
So he's seen kids grow up, marriages, grandkids, yeah, the whole shebang.
Just from talking, waiting.
And it's the same thing. They go in, they're like, ah, Peter, you're going to get this. Yeah. God damn it. And there's kind of a joy in the, you know, in the camaraderie of the brotherhood of actors.
Yeah, I guess I don't have a healthy sense of competition. Even when I did that role in Two Leslie, that guy pestered me for months to do that role. And I'm thinking, like, get John Hawk. You know, get Chris Pine. There's guys that could... They could do this.
Do you enjoy acting?
I think I do. I mean, I keep wanting to.
You prefer stand-up?
Well, I like stand-up because it's all you, and you go out there, and it's just you and
theater. How often are you doing stand-up?
I'm out pretty heavy. I just got back yesterday from 4 days Midwest. I did Madison, Milwaukee, Chicago, Minneapolis,
shit,
theaters. So you're going out there, you have an opener, they do the 20 minutes, 15 up front, and I go out there and do an hour and a half and get into that flow. It's very immediate.
So are you working on material all the time?
Totally.
Wow.
For most of my life. And then the thing with acting, and I talk about this a lot, is just that, you know, you do your 3 minutes, and then, okay, we're gonna reset, and then you go to the trailer.
Yeah, it's brutal.
For an hour. Hour and a half, 3 hours,
that's what's fun
4
about,
hours.
That's what's fun about directing and acting at the same time.
Oh, no spare time.
Yeah, there's no downtime.
Yeah.
It's like you feel like you're Chaplin or Buster Keaton or one of those guys back in the day that's just like...
Right, moving all the time.
Make.
Right, yeah. And you don't have that thing where you're sitting in the trailer, which are never that nice, even the nice ones.
No, you're angsting over something, and you're like, oh, fuck that. Yeah. I fucked that scene up.
Yeah.
There's no time for that.
But for you... Those times on camera, you got dip in?
No, but I did see dip over there.
It's a Zins.
Yeah. Oh, the old Zins.
No, yeah, they're
or
not
the new Zins.
New Zins, non-tobacco dip.
The fuck does that?
I don't know what it is. It's just
it's nicotine.
It's just nicotine. I think it's very powdered glass.
Great.
Soaked in nicotine.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. What I want. Yeah.
Yeah. No tobacco though. So it's great.
God damn it.
Yeah. I got two in right now.
God, good for you. Fuck. How are your gums doing?
I don't want to talk about it. I think they're all right. They were already receding. But what the question is, so the 5 minutes at a time that you're on set doing the thing, you know, putting together this massive movie, it justifies the 8 hours in the trailer.
It's a very good question, man. It's it is an incredible way to make a living, that's for sure. And the moments where you're rocking and rolling and you get into flow state or, you know, it's would be like anything. It's, you know, my version of you being on stage or whatever.
Sure. Shorter though.
But it's these microbursts, you know? I think the reason why people get paid big money for it is because after, let's say, a 15-hour day, and they're like, hey, Julia Roberts, it's time to go to your close-up where you're madly in love with so-and-so, and your wife, your mother's also died, and you got to perform. There's just like, there's no asterisk on the bottom of the screen that's saying that you've had a really hard fucking day. You got to go show up and fucking do the thing.
No to audience.
So that's, I think.
Well, yeah, that's the job.
But it's fucking, it's hard. There's a lot of downtime.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of downtime.
Well, I mean, when did you, like, what was the deal? You grew up all your life here.
I grew up, you're here in Glendale. I grew up 10 minutes away in North Hollywood, and I played sports and wanted to be a baseball player, and that's really all I thought about all of the time.
But even in the house, like, your dad, you weren't hanging out with Eric Estrada or anything.
Well, the show... the show was on from 76 or 77 to 81, I think.
Yeah.
So I was born in 80. So
so you didn't know.
I don't really remember much of any of that, really.
Yeah.
By the time I was 5 or 6, I think my dad was on Bold and the Beautiful for a couple years. And then.
Yeah. But you didn't go to sets? You didn't see him on TV?
The one set that I remember going to was Quantum Leap.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember seeing Scott Bakula and that thing, and Dean Stockwell.
Oh yeah,
and that was a big deal.
Yeah,
but no, we talked about it. And I love my father never calls them auditions. He calls them interviews, which I love. I fucking love it. Yeah, I've never ever heard him call it an audition.
Yeah,
going on an interview.
Yeah,
I think it's so cool. But it was something I grew up around, and a lot of my friends' parents were in the business, around the business, and
Like who?
When I was in grammar school, it was Zoe Winkler, whose father was Henry Winkler.
Yeah.
Sweetie Pie.
Yeah.
I actually just ran into her the other day. Annie Myershire, whose mom is Nancy Myers.
Yeah.
So I was around a bunch of those kinds of folks.
But so you're playing sports? No, no idea you're going to act?
No. I really wanted to be Don Mattingly.
Baseball?
Yeah, baseball.
Yeah. You were serious? Baseball.
I was serious insofar as I had a deep passion for it. I didn't have any. I mean, I had skill probably up until I was about, 13.
What position?
I played everything, but I ended up at first base.
Yeah, and
did you
could
play?
Hit? I played in Little League, and it wasn't a great experience.
No.
No, I my parents did what they could to try to get me involved.
No, not a lot of interest there.
I was on the equivalent of the Bad News Bears. It just was a fucking joke.
Great fucking movie.
It was a great movie.
God,
Walter Matthau.
Great fucking movie.
So funny. Yeah, I was a center fielder, and I famously somehow was under a pop fly and got hit in the face and broke my nose, and that kind of ended the dream, if I ever had it.
I got hit in the face when I was 17 by an 80-mile-an-hour fastball.
A pitch?
Pitch, right in the face.
Oh, my God.
Didn't break anything, thank God. But anyway, so I was playing baseball.
Yeah.
And in my senior year of high school, a class on Waiting for Godot on Samuel Beckett, and did the first act of Waiting for Godot in my senior year, and I enjoyed it, but I really didn't think anything of it. And then I went to college and made my way to the theater department
Where'd you go to college?
Went to Berkeley.
Oh, really? So you're up there?
I was up there for 3 years, and then a year of that was I did it in England, a year abroad. And
that's an interesting city to hang out in.
Berkeley?
Yeah.
Super. Oakland's interesting. San Francisco, I didn't spend much time in, and it's certainly, God, it's changed quite a bit since I was there.
Yeah.
You spent much time up there?
Yeah. I was there for a couple of years, and, I've worked up there.
Wow.
I lived in San Francisco for, I guess, a couple of years, and I was going back and forth to New York to do a TV gig that was a hosting gig. But I got a sense of it. It's a beautiful city, but it's
beautiful city.
It seems like, not unlike a lot of cities, it got fucked.
I think it's probably, it seems like where we're going as a country is just because it's so small, it's the microcosm of the death of the middle class. It's like really rich, really poor.
Yeah, and but also just the sort of no, sort of support system that works for the disenfranchised and the mentally ill and the drug addicted. And then once these downtowns, once people realize they don't have to leave their house to go to work, which I think the pandemic taught everybody, it just guts everything.
Yeah.
And it becomes a little weird. But I go to these smaller cities like Milwaukee even, where there's definitely an effort to kind of revive downtown. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't take. But
Where are you from?
I grew up in Albuquerque.
Oh, fuck. Wow.
But genetically, New Jersey.
But you grew up...
Folks are from Jersey.
You grew up in Albuquerque.
I did, yeah.
Did you like it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you like where you grow up generally. I loved it. It was a different town. I mean, you go to their shoot at all?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? What did you shoot out there?
I shot a film years and years ago called Carriers, and then I shot a film called Hell or High Water there maybe 7 years
ago. You and Ben shot that whole movie there?
Yep.
Really? Up in the mountains and around?
Yeah, exactly right.
I think people's, you know, what they experience when they go to Albuquerque, they're like, holy shit, it's beat up. What the fuck is this town? But when you grow up there and there's a nuance to it, and you grew up when there was sort of a middle class there, and it was always sort of a high crime rate-y kind of place, and it was always primarily Latino.
How'd your parents end up there?
I don't know, man. My dad was in the service for 2 years in Alaska, and he had a buddy who... My dad was a doc, and his buddy went down to Albuquerque because it was sort of a booming, a growing city, set up his practice there, said it was good. My dad went down there and did it.
Wow.
And I was in like second grade. Wow. So I went second grade through high school.
Alaska to New Mexico. That's a
Yeah. That's a I have trip. Some memories of Alaska. Not great.
Not great ones. No?
I can remember the terrain and a couple of weird babysitters, but that's about it.
Definitely don't have to go down that route.
I have been on stage. It's been pretty fucking weird.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I've worked out this bit about trauma that's kind of, it's growing into something kind of amazing and disturbing.
Are you working on it right now?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Fun.
Yeah. It's pretty fun, but it's kind of a heavy lift comedically.
So then with a bit like that, how long have you been working on it?
I don't know. It's probably going on 4 or 5 months, you know, and it's sort of unfolding into something, you know, as it goes.
And so when you say you're working on a bit, like, is there a point in time where that bit gets, like the Eddie Izzard Star Wars, just the first thing that came to mind?
Yeah.
Anyway, is there a time when that bit is done?
Kind of. I mean, yeah.
You get the first act, second act, third of it.
I think so, yeah. If you write like I do, which is on stage, you know, you talk through it and wait for things to be delivered to you, you know, in the moment, and then it's a surprise. I've become very addicted to that, where you have something that's funny enough, and then you keep bringing it out, and in moments of flow, as you would say, you know, new things kind of come in the moment. You're like, wow.
You go back after a show and then write it down, or you'll write it down.
I'll make note of it. I'll record it. I don't usually listen to it, but usually the ones that stick, and I keep going with it.
And so you're saying you're in this 4 or 5 month process of working out this bit of trauma. Every time you go on stage, there's a little nuance change here.
Exactly.
There's a context with the audience at that given time, what they're giving you.
Right. Like, and also like how I'm setting it up.
Yeah,
at first I was oversetting it up because it was a fragile bit. So I would have to say like, I just want you to know before I start talking about this that I can handle it. I would tell them.
Really?
Yeah. And whatever you guys do with it is on you. But I think we're going to lift it. It's going to be all right. And then they're like, oh, no.
Fuck, then, man. I think what you guys do is so admirable. I mean, my version of it, again, is like co-writing and directing and starring in a film. So I know the vulnerability of that. But to have the lifelong practice of being able to get up on stage,
right,
no matter what's given to you,
right,
handle it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's...
It's crazy when you put it like that.
Nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. And I haven't been doing it since I was 22, you know?
Imagine. I mean, it's nuts.
Oh, yeah. When you really think
about thick skin, you're just like, fucking whatever, man.
Yeah. And then, like, how do you evolve? How are you changing with it?
Yeah.
Like, the difference between me and me when I started and who my, you know, heroes were and what I was trying to do and how much control I had over it and what I can do now. It's kind of amazing. Well,
who are your heroes?
My heroes are the regular heroes, you know, Pryor and, you know, I was out here when I was 22, I was a doorman at the Comedy Store.
Oh, shit.
So I got taken in, you know, by Kennison and that crew, and I was, like, gotten some massive drug use. And that kind of
Sam Kennison?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. I know it's surprising. Everyone says that. Not that guy. but you know, all that stuff kind of adds up, you know?
Wow.
But ultimately, you get to a point where you're a certain age.
So Sunset Strip, what year?
87.
Oh, fuck. So, like, that's...
The Roxy.
Prime time Guns N' Roses.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, dude.
And they were all coming down the store.
Ah!
And it was like no cover night on Mondays. And it was just fucking nuts.
What a time, man.
It was nuts.
What a fucking time.
And because Sam was such a rock and roll freak, you know, he'd go to the Roxy and hold court. And
he'd go up there.
And then also all
the Rainbow Room.
Yep.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. He used to go up in there and eat. The Rainbow Room had the restaurant, right?
Wow.
Yeah. And then the porn, you know, that was high time for porn. So they were all around. It was crazy.
What a trip.
And I was just this coked up, angry Jewish kid.
God, you must have great fucking stories.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're great. They're not hero stories.
But they're good campfire stories. Go on.
For sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's definitely a pretty... prime Kennison story when it was right before I lost my mind, because eventually I coked myself into a psychotic state and had to get out.
Yeah.
But you were young, weren't you? How old are you?
87. I was 7 years old.
Yeah. No, you missed it.
No, I know I missed that.
Yeah, you missed. I missed the one from the 70s when the Sunset Strip. That, the early 70s in Hollywood, that must have been crazy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was just listening to the Zeppelin bio on tape, and that time sounds
crazy,
fucking gnarly.
So okay, so you give up sports.
Yeah.
Nice. Is that
one.
Hard?
Not good segue. I guess it was kind of difficult. I mean it's hard to be mediocre at something that you love.
Brother had to deal with that. My brother was a tennis guy,
really,
who wanted to go pro, and it's just like, at some point, if you
But was he good enough to actually touch pro?
He was on for his age group, he was on a pro doubles thing. He was he can play.
Yeah, that's way far past where I was.
Yeah, but he, like, ultimately, you got to be sort of genetically, it's like, you can work as hard as you want to work, but ultimately the thing that's going to cross you over is kind of untangible.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is whatever you want to call it, luck or fated or...
Yeah. I don't know.
And genetics, for sure.
Was that same with acting in a certain degree? You know, some guys just fit on screen.
It's a very bizarre thing, isn't it?
I don't understand it. I should fit better than I do. That's all I know. It's like, I got a big head.
It's a great name for a memoir.
Yeah, I should have fit on screen.
No, I should fit better than I do.
But that's me looking at myself. What do I know?
You know, you got a great big head.
Yeah, I should. It should work out. But there's something about, I don't know, man. Like, I'm taking an acting gig, and I'm just like, all right, so, like, what work are you going to do to make you feel like you're really doing this? Because I get this thing where I'm like, I make all these choices, you know, I do some character work, and then 3 days in, I'm like, I'm just being me. What happened? I'm just...
Yeah, but don't you think that's ultimately... I think there's definitely character work in that regard, and whatever it is, the fucking accent.
Yeah, yeah,
you're doing,
yeah.
Whatever, a twitch, but I think really what people pay to see is your
thing,
deal.
Yeah, I think so.
There's nothing more unique than your precise deal.
Yeah,
you don't have to dress it up with really much of anything.
Well, it's like, but character actors do a different thing, right?
They do. They're, you know, I remember we did a film called Shadow Recruit, this Jack Ryan film, and I was working with Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
And Kevin said something to me that always stuck with me, is that, you know, the hardest work of a leading man, so to speak, is just holding, it's like a ballast in a ship. No one's ever really, you're not always going to talk about the ballast of the ship, but without the ballast of the ship, nothing else gets done.
Right.
Is that you have to, like, occupy space enough to be kind of winning.
Yeah.
But not so much space that you take away from the story. Your job is pretty much to be...
Service
the story in some ways, the audience surrogate. Yeah. And I always thought that was really interesting, is that because I think growing up as a younger actor, you get turned on, or at least I did, a lot by the character actors, the guys that are doing all the fun shit.
Yeah.
You know, the bad guys, the Lee Marvins or whatever.
Lee Marvin.
But, you know, the leading men, it's a difficult and tricky gig because you have to, like, know how to be, it's not blank, but you have to be, that's like exactly what I said. Enough in the space of the film and enough away from the film so people can occupy space with you and kind of go on the journey with you and they can become you.
Right. Also, though, some of that is just like through self-awareness that you are that guy that, you know, that you're
going to... You can get out of your own way. And that's 100%. That is such a huge learning lesson, at least was for me. It's a version of stop trying so hard.
Yeah.
That, because the camera is so, it's so intelligent that it'll just pick up.
Right.
As long as you have enough going on.
Right.
And it's really true. And you kind of take a tally as you're working. You're like, that fucking thing.
You know,
I kind of definitely pushed too hard there. And I can track in a movie where I'm like, I could have taken that back 115% and still been totally fine.
Right. And those are the learning moments.
Yeah. I mean, my God. There's...
Right now I'm in the try to breathe with your mouth closed.
While you're sleeping?
No, on camera.
Like, yeah.
Because I'm a mouth breather guy. And like I've noticed when I'm not talking, I'm like, dude, you shut your fucking mouth.
I know. I mean, I'm just thinking about like a page of dialogue or whatever. Yeah. Page of dialogue, you just make it sound... Like you're me talking. And Mark are talking,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And there's certain things. It's like, if I'm talking, I'm doing a lot of this. I'm like, Mark, but don't you fucking see, man? It's like, whatever. Yeah. And you're like in a tight. Maybe you don't do that. But for the majority of it, to maintain authenticity, you're doing the same fucking thing.
Sure.
Now, they're also like the great Michael Caine, How to Act on Film stuff, which is don't blink, look at one eye, look at the corner of the eye that's closest to the camera, all these little tricks that you definitely can employ, but for the majority of it,
you just got to do it. You got to be in it.
I think you have to, just make it sing.
Yeah.
I love that you feel like you're still trying to figure it out. Are there things in comedy you feel like you're still trying to figure out, or you feel like samurai status?
No. I like, there are things I want to do. Like, you know, there are things like, you know, later in my career, I started employing callbacks, you know, during the show, and then also physical comedy. For me, you know, I have a subtle physical comedy that's natural, but if I want to do a bigger, broader bit, I got to figure out the beats and I figure out the action and start repeating it. Like, you know, I did at the end of my last special, I did a big physical bit and, you know, timing out the physicality. So I want to get a laugh on that.
And you'd never had done that earlier in your career.
No. I just kind of like got by with talking and impulse and, you know, and then eventually sitting. But like I've become aware that if I want to do these bigger bits, especially if they need physicality, I got to work them.
Mm.
I got to make physical choices.
Mm.
Yeah.
I was watching a lot of, before I made my film, a lot of the silence, Buster Keaton especially,
really?
and Charlie and Harold Lloyd. And it's an amazing, especially thinking about comedy.
Yeah.
I'm reading this book that you may find it fascinating. I certainly do. It's called The Oral History of Hollywood. And these guys took all of these conversations that they had, not they, AFI had with people in the industry starting in the 70s with people that had went all the way back to the inception of film. But, you know, comedians coming from vaudeville, coming from the stage circuit, coming from where things were really big, coming from the silence where there's no words to speak of. So it's all in the face. It's all...
Right.
With the physical comedy, what they were able to do, like the breadth of how they were able to use their body for comedy, is just mind blowing.
Totally,
and over and over and over and over again.
Right.
I think it's kind of like a lost art. I mean, it is a lost art.
Yeah, unless you're a clown.
I guess unless you're a clown, but I mean,
some guys are really good at it, and if I'm jealous,
are there guys on the circuit that are
still more physical?
Yeah,
I guess so. But there are guys in movies that I can tell are naturally gifted physical comedians, and I'm always sort of a little jealous of it. You know, like back in the day, like when Stiller sets his mind to it,
yeah.
I mean, he's funny as fuck.
Oh, forget
and,
about
and
it.
And same with, what's his name? You know, the Canadian who's...
Carey.
Jim Carrey. No, the other one. The guy who... He's a big...
Ryan Reynolds.
Ryan Reynolds. Great physical comedian.
Great physical comedian.
You know, and I don't know how much thought he puts into it, but he can fucking do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a thing.
Yeah.
There are guys... Kevin James, you know, is like just naturally... They're those guys that get on stage and they're just like, they're so uncomfortable or they're just so, in you know, naturally expressive.
Yeah, but that's a different thing. I mean, I think that's more of like your nat.
Yeah, you're just like that.
Yeah, you look at someone like it, there's something naturally funny happening with this human in his physical body that is fun to watch. I'm talking about like the art of whatever.
Some guys do it.
The
they
double
have it.
Take or whatever the fuck it would be.
Right.
I'm not quite
but
sure.
If you watch like Stiller in The Thing About Mary, it's fucking nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like it's almost silent movie slapstick status.
What comedians are you following now that you like?
Well,
of the younger generation.
I know there's so many though. You know, Bargatze is great. Nate, you know, and now I'm at that age where it's like, yeah, he used to open for me. You know, I remember that kid. You know, there's some guys that you know can kind of do voices and like kind of tell a story with all the characters. I'm always sort of envious of that.
Yeah,
Maria Bamford's a genius.
Yeah. I don't know if I know Maria Bamford.
Yeah, she's something. I like Taylor Tomlinson. Mm-hmm. You know, she's a real deal.
So you follow?
Well, I see them when I go to work.
Oh yeah.
So if I go to the Comedy Store, if I'm in town, I'm there a couple nights a week. Fahim Anwar is great. He's just
so funny. Do you?
He's very physical. He's funny. He can do all the voices.
But you're not because you're around it so much in your life.
Yeah,
it's not like you're. Are you watching Netflix specials? And
I do more now because if I talk to my peers, I want to know where they're at. Dave Attell was just here. He's very funny.
Yeah.
So I watch them more now. Roy Scovel is a new Netflix HBO special.
Mm.
Roy Scovel, great.
Mm.
Like very kind of disarming and kind of. You know, does a lot of physical stuff, but deep stuff. Like I was sort of surprised because I always thought, and I've known him for years. I thought he was a goofball, and I watched his special. I'm like, man, he's really doing the thing.
Mm. Mm.
What about you, actor wise? Are there guys like you worked with Denzel? That must have been.
Oh, Denzel's he's a master. I mean, it's.
What was
fun.
That show? It was the Runaway Train one. What was that?
Unstoppable.
Called?
I mean, I grew up watching his stuff, so
yeah.
It was. I think most of the time I was working with Tony Scott, who directed Top Gun, which is one of my favorite movies growing up, and I was working with Denzel. You know, the amount of the awe factor that was kind of just taking over. Ethan was in a different place in his career. I mean, I had made. I think you could count the number of films I made on one hand when I worked with Denzel.
Well, you've done a lot, but maybe not that big a deal.
No, not at all.
You'd already done Captain Kirk to a degree, right?
I did. I had done one.
A movie.
One Star Trek.
Yeah.
It's incredible. He's an incredible, his command of, I mean, I saw it all the way from the development of the script through him working with Tony to obviously shooting. And it was essentially a two-hander because it was me and him in the train.
Yeah.
So there, you know, it was just me and him in a space literally this big.
Yeah.
For months. It was like, it was an acting class. I learned like what he was able to nix out of a backstory. There was a whole backstory that he had that had gotten a lot of airtime on screen that he had no use for.
Like, really? Like, what do you mean? Like,
he just knew that what he could deliver in terms of emotional, the bang for buck of having Denzel on screen, what he was able to achieve just by virtue of him showing up, negated having to have explicating the relationship he had with his wife or whatever.
Right.
And as a younger actor, I was concerned very much with having a moment to be able to talk about my wife or whatever. But I learned a lot from his just confidence and knowing, which is what we were talking about before, what he was able to bring just by virtue of having a camera on his face.
Well, how much of your education with the thing has just been on the job? I mean, did you study acting after college?
I did plays and, I went to a college, Berkeley, that didn't have a conservatory program.
Okay.
And a theater program, but, you know, it wasn't. I could have majored in theater. I didn't have majored in English.
Yeah.
A lot of it, I think, was not, I think. I learned most of my stuff just working.
But you did theater before?
I did a lot of theater in college and then after college.
What did you do after college? I think my producer kind of knew of you when you were up in Massachusetts.
I did two seasons at a place called the Williamstown Theater Festival, yeah. which is a great kind of summer rep place
yeah.
In Williams.
Before you did any TV or movies?
Yeah. And then I did a one-man show in New York when I was about 25 called The Atheist. I did Neil Labute's Fat Pig in L.A. at the Geffen, and then I did Lieutenant of Inishmore at the Geffen as well, at the Mark Taper.
Yeah. So was that the thing? Did you think you were going to be a theater guy?
I definitely wanted to make it a large part of my career, and I was going to actually move to New York before I got my first gig and was dead set on pursuing it. And I would imagine it's just like, it's the closest I can get to what you get is that energy of like, there's very little of that aliveness yeah. when you're performing for
right.
a bunch of grips and gaffers. You
yeah.
know? And
yeah.
I had so much stage fright. I have recurring anxiety dreams that it's always the same thing. I'm about to go on stage. I've completely forgotten my lines and I'm supposed to like sing a song that I have to make up on the spot. It's fucking terrifying. Terrifying.
Yeah. But so the acting role started to come, like you did some TV?
Yeah, I did some TV and then I got a
film. Did you do like CSI?
I did CSI with
Caruso?
With Caruso.
How was that? I was wondering what happened to that guy because I saw him in a bit part in an old movie and I was just sort of like, oh, there he is. It was, oh, I remember what it was. I watched Friedkin's Cruising. The other
Holy
night.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
It's funny. I was on Criterion or something.
Yeah.
I was going to watch that too. It popped up on the
It's
on
a
the
lot,
thing.
Dude. It's a lot.
Yeah. Is it good?
I think it is. There is a sense that he's cramming as much gay in there as he can. There's a.
Like, and they get gay in it.
Real gay. Like, you know, Pacino's undercover in the meatpacking right. district in the 80s.
Fuck.
And every bar, there's like some guy blowing a guy. There's a guy fucking a guy in the ass. And there's like some guy in a harness and another dude greasing up his hand. And this is all in one bar, you know? And I'm like, wow.
It's in a oneer.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a,
it's a long oneer.
He's getting it all in, literally. But it does have an interesting twist, and I do think that Caruso's in it for a second as a cop. And I always wonder what happened to that guy. Did you have a good experience with that?
I think he did whatever, 12 seasons of that show.
I know, yeah, it's enough.
Made
yeah,
a
yeah.
fortune. I played the bad guy. I raped my girlfriend, something awful. And,
yeah. How old are you then?
I was 24.
Yeah.
And then. I killed my girlfriend with on the show.
Yeah.
With Saran wrap. And in one take, I remember Caruso coming behind me and wrapping my face with the Saran wrap, which was not scripted.
Right.
Which was terrifying.
Yeah.
And the producer go, okay, cut, let's take five.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Worried that I was going to call human resources
right.
or something.
Why do you do that? He wanted you to feel it?
I don't know. He's making a choice.
So wait, Star Trek, that changed your whole life, right?
Yeah.
And you're happy about it?
I mean, absolutely.
Do the Trekkies like you?
I have no idea. I think it's, you know, I think it's as it goes. Some do, some don't.
Yeah,
I don't
sure.
think there's really any way to fully win in that scenario. But I had a great time, and I mean, I really lucked out in terms of, it was a great script, it was a great film,
yeah,
and it was great people to work with, and
yeah.
it completely changed the course of my
and
career.
And how'd you study for Kirk, an established character?
I was lucky in one regard, is I hadn't seen a lot of the show. So,
yeah.
I mean, I knew Shatner more as like a cultural icon than
right.
I did as an actor playing
yeah,
a character.
I was
character.
Never a fantasy guy either.
So I had an idea and I watched the first season of the show and I got a sense of like what he was all about. And JJ never wanted me to do anything other than just do me. But it's inevitable when you're playing someone who's that fun to watch.
Yeah.
You can't not want to do Shatner.
Sure.
At some point in
yeah.
the process.
So, right.
You know, here and there, I'd throw in a little Shat just to make the day go by. Or
you do a Shat flourish?
Yeah, and a Shat flourish is anything from how you sit in a chair to cross your legs
yeah.
or how, you know, there's he does a thing with his his jaw that's very particular. Yeah. So you just, you know, you flavor it like you're making a soup, you know, not too much.
So you didn't get locked into a TV Star Trek. You just did the movie.
I did three movies.
Three.
I did one in 2007 and one in 2002.
Oh yeah, Into the Darkness.
One, and then one in 2016.
Yeah. Now the Jack Ryan thing, it wasn't quite a franchise when you did it, was it?
It was a franchise insofar as they'd done, bunch of different ones with Harrison Ford and Alec Baldwin.
Yeah, yeah.
Mostly Harrison, and then they hadn't done a film. No, that's not true. Ben Affleck did a film, and then I did a film. Yeah. My film flopped, and then they did the show with Krasinski.
And that so that was just a TV show, not the movies.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that's how he locked into it.
Yeah.
Yours flopped?
Didn't do well.
What do you think? What happened?
Really one of the big regrets. I love that character so much. I mean, I grew up watching all of those films. It just didn't connect.
Do you, when you watch movies that don't connect that you're in, do you see it? How often have you thought it was your fault?
Never.
Good.
I think it's, film is the most collaborative art, maybe more collaborative than anything else.
Yeah.
There's so many cooks in the kitchen.
And, sure.
No, I would never, I'd never say that about myself. I think I
showed up.
I know I show up to work all the time. Yeah, yeah. There's never one time that I'm like,
I tell you though, man, that Hell or High Water, I watched that a few times.
Thanks, man.
I fucking love that movie.
It's a great film.
It's great.
It's a really good, good Western, man.
Yeah. And you guys acted the fuck out of that thing.
We had a blast.
I bet. He's an intense fucker, that Foster.
Well, he's the best.
I mean,
do you know him?
I interviewed him.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And I was nervous.
Were you really?
Yeah. Yeah, because I he's one of those guys that's like, what is this guy really like? I mean, what am I going to be dealing with, Because he's one of those transformational actors.
100%. I think the thing about Ben is that underneath all of the intensity is a really sweet, he's a sweetie pie.
Yeah.
He's a sweetie pie and he's tremendously gifted and he's able to channel, his beautiful, complicated spirit into his work. But really at the end of the day, he's a, simple teddy bear.
It's interesting because you got to be like the kind of the grounded dude.
Yeah, it was really fun.
And did you know, I guess it's just in the script that you had this brother who was, a little.
Yeah, I had, because the script that Taylor had written was so, it was like cowboy poetry.
Yeah.
So I knew that the character I was playing was of a certain breed of kind of.
Yeah.
I don't know, Gary Cooper or.
Right.
Just the silent stoic type.
Yeah.
And I was really excited to. I had never gotten a chance to do something like that. And I had such an image in my mind of this guy and how I was going to play him. And it was great. It was very simple. I was the quiet stoic type. Ben was the fucking insane brother.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's how the two fit together. We'd done a film. We had just done a film together, Ben and I. So we had
spent
a lot of time together. A film called Finest Hours.
Okay. So you knew how each other worked.
Yeah.
That's good.
So it was just relatively seamless. It was easy camaraderie.
Right. But it's interesting when it's a genre film that's honoring the genre. And so you're
it's one of the very few scripts I've read in my career. And I think I've read, a handful where you finish and you're like, that is a perfect fucking, you could shoot that right now.
Yeah.
And not change a word. And it is, so long as no one fucks up and gets in its way, it's great. And that was one of them. So.
Yeah.
And it read like it was, I call them like music boxes. They're just, you open it and it plays just the right notes.
Right.
Of what that is.
It's rare, right?
Yeah. I mean, rare. It's one in a, once in a blue moon.
I just read one and they attached me to it and I was excited about it. It was a dark comedy and now it's a little stalled and I don't know if it's going to happen. But, I don't get offered a ton of stuff. But this one, they had me in mind, and it was like, oh my God, this is the fucking greatest script. This is like, it just because it's tight. You know, like, you, at no point are you like, what's happening now?
Or you're like, God, the first act needs some help. That scene, they could, like, we should rework that. It's so nice to be like, no, that just is.
It's just all there.
What's happening with the thing?
I don't know. I think that they're looking for maybe bigger talent, so maybe I won't be attached. I don't know how it's going to happen, but.
Is there money behind it?
Yeah, there's some, but they kind of got stalled on getting all of it.
Oh, yeah. How much is it?
It's not a lot. It's a small movie, you know?
Shoots here?
Yeah. I know. It'd be great. I was ready to spend my summer doing that, and then it just went away. And then I got offered this other thing where I actually have to go out of town, and it was like just, you know, at this point in my life where I don't need to do anything really, it's a tough decision. And I don't even have a family.
It's not even really a tough decision. What a great thing. You don't have to fucking work if you don't want to work. It's got to be that right thing.
Right, but there's also the thing that is like, well, if you want to act and you turn this down,
but I asked you in the beginning of this, do you like acting? You're like, I think I do.
Well, that's enough. There's a part of me. Look, man, I'm fucking 60, and certain things, you know, everything that I've wanted to do has happened, but nothing's ever really blown up. You know,
so you're waiting for the blown up thing.
Well, I mean, look, I did Glow on Netflix.
Yeah,
and that was good.
Yeah.
And I like doing that. I like the character. I like the way it came out. It was a unique, interesting thing. But it's not like at 60, all of a sudden, I'm going to be like, thank God we have a new leading man. It's not going to happen. And that's
sort
of.
But do you want that?
I don't know. It's a childhood fantasy. Whether I want it or not, it doesn't matter, is what I'm telling you.
That's very true.
You know, so like, I'm going to be like the cranky sidekick. And just what version of that?
But this is a meaty conversation, okay. Starting point. You just said most things that you've wanted in your career have happened.
Yes.
But yet you still have that.
A little off to the side.
Okay, whatever.
Yeah.
All intents and purposes, sure. They've all fucking
yes.
worked
yes.
out.
Yes, yeah.
But you still have that little bit of static energy of the frustration of something hasn't quite clicked yet. If you were to articulate that.
It's childish.
No, but what is it? I'm curious.
Well, you want to be like hey, there's that guy.
You want to be loved more.
I guess. Yeah,
that makes all the sense in the world.
Just so I can, you know, push it away.
I don't want it. I know exactly what that's all about.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And what? How have you dealt with it?
You know, 25 years of therapy, and I think, you know, this film is a great for someone like me that has the same thing that
new movie Pullman. Yeah.
It premiered in Toronto, got absolutely annihilated critically.
So the love didn't come.
The love didn't come.
Yeah.
So for someone who's a needy artist,
yeah,
to really get very real with what it is I'm like, you know, what that static energy.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's
is
where
all
I'm
about.
At. That's where I'm at. Like,
you know, what is it all about? Am I going to get it? Do I need it? Is it worth it? Is there sustenance there? Is it a viable? And it's just not. Quite honestly, it's just not because it's never going to
be enough.
The hole's never going to get filled.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
You mean the God-shaped hole?
The God-shaped hole.
Yeah, fucker.
That fucking fucker.
Yeah. I fill it a lot. I fill it with a lot of coffee. And
coffee and nicotine.
Coffee and nicotine, dude.
Hey, pal. I'm
yeah,
with you.
You know what's up. Yeah, I can't do any other shit. I've been sober for 25 years. That didn't work out.
God yeah. damn it.
But this is one of those things where, like, I was pushing back on it, even though I know, like, I could do it. It's kind of a role I could do. And there's still that part of me where the last movie I did, I engaged some craft. I did an accent. The last two roles, they weren't me. I was able to shut off. I find that in terms of acting, a lot of what you do is like, well, the parts that aren't me, I just shut off. Like, you know, this
whoa,
guy.
Whoa, 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 what?
I mean, like, if the character I'm playing is not neurotic,
okay,
then I'm not. Then right. I can turn that part of me off and still show up
right.
as the guy.
Gotcha.
So the craft in place is like, you know, don't be self-reflective.
Got you.
Right? Those are choices.
Right. Continue.
So the point is that this one, there's still a couple of things that I've learned since the last acting I've done that I'd like to try to employ and see if I can, you know, show up for it. I've been told emotionally I can do it. I can listen. I can be present.
Yeah.
You know, but what's going to make it not so 3 days in, I'm like, no, I'm not doing anything. And no one's giving me notes. And they're signing off on this shit. And so I guess I'm just going to do this.
So it sounds okay. So it sounds like, for what I'm hearing from you, good therapy talk.
Yeah,
what I hear you saying, Mark, is that you want to disappear into something and kind of forget about Mark for a second.
That'd be wow. Is that possible?
I mean,
I don't know. Can you do it?
No.
Okay.
No. So
no hope there.
No.
All right, but let's talk about, like, before we talk about Pool Man. With these Marvel movies, like, you did Wonder Woman.
I did Wonder Woman, yeah. That's a DC film, Mark.
Oh, I was in a DC movie. I prefer the DC movies.
Good man.
I had one scene in Joker with De Niro. That was a big day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Fucking A. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm his producer.
Fuck.
That was kind of funny.
So you weren't there for the bloodletting or no?
Sure, I had to be. I was when he gets shot.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Because I was on set. I was the producer of the TV show, so I had to stand there, for a week without doing anything but standing there.
Oh my God! Oh, that's great fun. I've done that before.
Yeah, but the bloodletting was all done after.
Yeah.
So it was interesting to watch De Niro work.
Oh my God! I was gonna say shit.
Because it's like you're watching him. And you're just looking at him as a person on a set doing this thing. And part of me was like, oh, God, how are they going to make this work? But he knows.
About Robert De Niro.
Right. Yeah. Because his process, as he gets older, is that, he likes to load up the lines, it seems, with that role, like, almost on set with some of them. He's playing a TV guy. He's made a choice about the guy, which is fine. And it was good, but the way it cut together, I was like, holy shit, he knew the whole time, because he's such a pro that, whatever he was working with in the moment that wasn't locking in, it didn't matter, because they'd find the ones that did, and you'd get your money's worth.
Well, that is definitely a big learning process with film. It took me forever to remember, is like, film is an art form made in the edit.
Yeah, totally.
So it's like you don't have to be on stage and get the whole scene right.
Were you offered Marvel shit?
No.
Was that something like Wonder Woman is a big movie?
Yeah.
For the DC
movie? But during the time that I think I was doing the two Wonder Woman films and Happy as a Clam.
Yeah. It's a good gig?
Yeah, it's a great gig, and I love working with Patty and Gal and my character's not a superhero, which I really liked playing, just a normal guy.
The pilot guy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was great fun.
So this, the movie that I watched last night, it's weird, and I didn't mention it before, with Hell or High Water. It's like, that was the first time I was like, who the fuck's this guy?
That's cool. All right.
You know what I mean?
I'll take it.
Yeah. I was like, there's a movie star here. Does everyone know about this guy?
You go on Reddit. Guys.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you know this, but this guy Pine's a movie star. So how does, because I get all the references, or most of them, there's probably layers of them in Pool Man. Because I just watch China. I watch Chinatown like 3 times a year.
It's the best.
Right. It's totally the best.
Oh my God. I just saw it at the Los Feliz 3.
Oh my God. Curly, when you're right, you're right. And you're right.
God.
Burt so Young.
Burt Young's great.
Clamping onto the blinds. Oh. But it's a deep reference for this movie. I mean, even on the plot line.
I think it is in some ways. I mean,
it's about water.
I mean, it's about water, and it's about LA, and he watches Chinatown, I think. And then this insane plot that happens to lead to the end with a moment with the femme fatale. But I guess I never really thought about it. There is noir elements to it. It's essentially every film I've ever watched seemingly put through my brain and come out the other end. It's like a, there's elements of, you know, like screwball comedy. I'd watched Bogdanovich. I'd seen the What's Up Doc and really loved that. And David O. Russell, certainly with how families talk and how the overlapping neurotic chaos of families.
And you got great cast. You got Benning. You got DeVito.
Yeah. I mean,
Jason Lee.
I lucked out. Yeah. DeWanda Wise.
And who's the guy
who plays Tobolowsky, who I love?
I haven't seen him in a while.
He's
great.
The best.
And the guy who played your buddy?
Oh, John Ortiz. Yeah.
He's great. I've been seeing him a lot lately.
He was in American Fiction recently.
Yeah. I saw him in that. He was like, there's some amazing stuff in Silver Linings Playbook with him.
Amazing.
Amazing.
That's what I'd seen that right before and I was like, oh, John Ortiz is it. John Ortiz is it.
And he was excited to do it.
Yeah, he was great. Everybody had we had a blast. It was a lot of fun.
So your character, though, the pool guy, that's just, to me, like, there's a little Lebowski to it.
There's Lebowski to it in some regard. I mean, Darren, my character, there's no drinking, there's no pot smoking, and I think instead of—
But there's meditating.
There's meditating, but I think instead of, like, a Lebowski who's, I characterize as, like, deep passivity, and by virtue of this story happening to him, has to become active,
right,
but
you
resents it.
Right.
I think my character's way more...
It's like the opposite.
Yeah, he's like a big beating heart. He's like a puppy dog.
But also, I think what I liked about it is that it is a specifically California character. Like that guy, like if you live here long enough...
100%.
Like that guy's...
He's guys that you've seen on... getting back to like growing up in the industry, there's an LA that's really romantic. There's like a P.T. Anderson LA that's like kind of deep valley. The one I was exploring was definitely the kind of outcasts of the Hollywood dream that like had touched the Hollywood dream and had been actors or acted before.
Yeah.
Or had been a director. But had never really made it and end up living in this rundown motel. And that was kind of my ode to this is a fucking hard town. And I've been very lucky. And my parents have been very lucky, but I know the other side of like people clawing, trying to get in.
Yeah.
And there's this group of people is definitely in that world, I think.
Yeah. And when you wrote this thing, you had decided that you wanted to write and direct?
Not really, man. I this began because I had this title, Poolman, and this guy's name, Darren Behrman, and it just really made me laugh.
Yeah.
And I kept on thinking about it, and it rolled around in my head, and a year went by, and it was like still rolling around in my head.
Yeah.
And then I tried to hire a screenwriter and met the screenwriter a couple times, but then he was off busy doing something, and then COVID hit and was going through some personal stuff. And I was like, fuck it. So I sat down with my writing partner, my producing partner. We spent a lot of time, we wrote it. And then it just seemed at that point, because as I was writing it, I saw the whole thing, and this began as much bigger kind of conception of a story that was much more fantasy, I would say.
Yeah.
And then I just ended up directing. It just seemed like it seemed inevitable, basically.
Yeah. There's still a lot of fantasy to it.
Oh yeah. This was certainly something I'd thought about before, but it has really become like concrete in watching it again. It's like, this is a film as if it were made by a guy named Darren Behrman. As if like Darren Behrman, this pool man, had got the dream of his life to make a film. There's like a DIY quality to it that I don't know, makes me fucking get, it just makes me laugh. And it's completely, you know, there's a cop thing at the end that's like not really totally sure if they're really cops or not.
Right.
Or if
this
is just like what Darren wants to happen.
Right. You know. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah. And how much of it, in terms of your relationship with DeVito and Benning's characters, was, you know, kind of based on your life?
A lot of it. I mean, my mother was an actress who became a psychotherapist. She's not a Jungian analyst, but she's a psychotherapist. Jack Denisoff, who is DeVito, He's a former B-movie director that made horror films in the 80s and hasn't gotten anything going on for a long time.
Yeah.
Has a very questionable relationship with his agent who may not be returning his calls or has ever returned his calls. So, again, it's like growing up in my household that was – there was work. There was no work. There were periods of, like, pretty financially desperate times and – you know, rolling around in that world of what's my next shot? Like, you know, put me in, coach.
Yeah.
Definitely, definitely.
I also like that the pool man does not do one job.
No, his job is taking care of the pool at this apartment complex, and that seems to be the only pool he takes care of.
Yeah. And Jennifer Jason Leigh was great, but DeVito's so, like, to see Benning and DeVito and you, like, that guy can just show up, it seems, and be DeVito and just nail it.
Danny DeVito is the happiest actor I've ever met in my entire life.
He loves doing it.
He is happy doing press. He is happy doing a bit with craft service.
Yeah.
He's happy watching Monitor. He's happy watching the fucking premiere. He loves every part of our job. And so it was so joyful to be around someone who's been in it and has done, if you look at his fucking career, it's mind-boggling.
It is.
Like he begins One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, then he gets Taxi, then his career, then he directs, then he does fucking Hoffa amongst many other things, then he does Jersey Films, he produces Pulp Fiction. I mean, his career spans a hell of a lot of filmmaking. So, and to have the two of them together, you know, Annette, it works from one stylistically in one different way, and Danny works in a whole different way, and they love one another, and to direct both of them was a dream.
And what was your first decisions? Because I want to direct a movie. I'm trying to put one together with my buddy's book. What was your first, like, when you knew you were going to do it, what'd you put in place first? Like a DP? Like, what was your thoughts?
I got a DP and a costume designer. I got a DP, I got my costume designer, then I got my production designer. Locations was kind of a nightmare just because everybody was booked and we had no money ever. Locations was tricky, much trickier than I thought, much more expensive than I thought.
Because you shot it all here?
Yeah.
No tax breaks?
I shot here on film with tax breaks, 21 days.
Oh wow! So you knocked it out.
It was a lot. And no. And then I got my sound guy because the sound guy, Peter Devlin, I'd worked with since I was like 25 or something, and
he's
won an Academy Award and is a big deal and really saved me.
And who is that actress who played the femme fatale?
DeWanda Wise.
She's great.
Great, isn't she?
Yeah. Where's she from? I mean, what's she been in?
She, Jurassic Park was the last big film she was in right now. She's in a new film, a horror film, called Imaginary.
Yeah.
I think for Jason Blum. She's lovely and came in. I lost my actress very close to shooting and it just so happened she lived down the street from where we were shooting at the Tiki T, the motel, and was easy as pie and just a joy to work with.
Wow. So that worked out.
Yeah, totally.
Now, after all is said and done here and it's out in the world, I mean, are you like, I'm going to do another?
100%. It's such a high, I can't even tell. Like, I've been in a state of, I think, profound grief for a year because exactly what you're talking about. I've always wanted to make a film. Speed is not something that has ever been a part of the filmmaking process that I've been a part of. And because the acting directing component of it is that there's no downtime, it always feels like you're creating.
Yeah.
And it's like a high. It's I can't imagine. I can't imagine not doing it again. And I have some ideas that are totally different than Poolman that have kind of turned me on. So, but then you also see, like, my God, and if you're about to get into the process, it's just the incredible amount of time. As an actor, as a comic, it's like you show up, do your bit, you're gone.
Yeah.
And then you show up to the fucking premiere a year later. And these poor motherfuckers, it's years. It's been 4 years of my life, more or less.
Right. That's what's always kind of...
It's like unfucking believable. Because then not only do you finish the edit, then you're waiting for the thing to come out.
Right.
Then you have to work on the marketing process.
Yeah.
It's that's always a thing.
That's always why I've been turned, like, not wanting to do it. I talk to guys who are like, yeah, this took 5 years to make. I'm like, I'm out.
Yeah, I get it. I'm with you, man. But are you going to be in the thing that you want to direct?
Just for a smaller part. Because I've directed, when I did my TV show, I've directed episodes of it. And I didn't really get the feeling that I was really directing. It was just like, I do a shot and we didn't have money or time to really play back as much as I wanted. So I just had to rely on the DP to be like, yeah, we got it. I'm like, you sure? Yeah, good.
I think also, too, because you already get that high from being on stage. Mm. Like, I'm chasing that. Chasing the... It could all collapse at any moment. Feeling
right. You know? Yeah, yeah, and I. I don't want to be in the movie. I do want to produce it, and I'm working with my friend to, you know, kind of put the script together. And it's like, and I don't know who's. It's a young people's movie, so I don't even know those actors. Mm. So it'll be interesting if we get it over. You know, get it into shape and make it happen.
Are you excited about it?
Very. To the point where I never really wanted to direct because it just takes so much time.
You know, but is your experience, because it's mine, it's like you just can't, it seems like it's inevitable and will happen.
Well, yeah, that's how certain things in my life have happened. That's like, so, for no matter how it's received or whatever, it's like, I want to try. And you get to a point where you put that in your heart and your mind. And then, you know, all of a sudden it's like, oh, I'm ready to try.
And then that's exactly right.
Right.
That's exactly what happened to me.
Yeah.
And it's like, I can't imagine this process happening any other way.
Right.
Especially, you're dreaming about it, and you're like daydreaming, you're thinking about shots, and you're like, oh, that would be cool.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the process that's happening.
And also, like, going into something for the first time, there's that other part from having experience in show business where you're like, it might not be perfect, it might not be whatever, but I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And in having been in things that, you know, were never seen, or I knew when I did my series on IFC that, like, I don't know how to do this acting thing, really. So for two seasons, I'm going to not know what to do with my hands or whatever. Like, I'm going to notice that I don't know how to do this. But there's no other way. I'm going to have to take the hit.
And it's fucking thrilling. And what's really thrilling about it, too, is, and I'm sure you feel that about your shows, like, you know, at the end of the day, from A to Z, from the moment of the first fucking pebble in my brain to the moment where the last piece of marketing goes out before the premiere, I have ownership of that whole thing.
That's right.
For better or for worse.
Right.
You may not like it or whatever, but it's mine.
Yeah.
And that is rad.
It is rad. You know, and in this, in the sort of media climate where, like, there's just, you know, so much shit out there, you don't even have to judge it in relation to anything.
No.
You're just sort of like, if this gets seen anywhere, we've delivered the goods.
God, isn't that the truth?
Man? Yeah.
Yeah.
Good talking to you, man.
You too.
There you go. What a good guy. Swell guy. Enjoyed talking to him. Pool Man. His new movie is in theaters Friday, May 10th. Hang out for a minute, people.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
On Thursday's show, comedian Joe Mandy is back, and if you're a WTF Plus subscriber, you can go listen to episode 142, which was Joe's first episode where he told some pretty great stories.
In ninth grade, I took Spanish in high school. It was the only non-honors class I ever took. I showed up the first day, ninth grade, so I was very short and braces and sweater vests. I don't know why I wore sweater vests. And
what
I
made you do that?
What? I thought it was cool. and I got into Spanish the first day of class, and it was just me and the JV basketball team. That was the class, basically.
Right.
And I was like, it'll be fine. I listened to Outkast or whatever. And I sit down, and they were just ruthless. They would make fun of me. They would call me names. They would choke me. I got choked a lot, but it was never violent. They just would come up from behind when I wasn't expecting it and like wrap. Sometimes it was like piano wire. I don't like they had piano wire. They would like wrap wire around my neck, and I would freak out. Obviously,
yeah,
and then they would let go and just crack up. They'd be like, "Ah, ha, ha, you stupid!"
Yeah, yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and he's like, "Oh, okay.
He's frightened for the right reason."
Right.
What an idiot!
Right. What an idiot! I was like, "How stupid of me to freak out!"
Yeah.
So it was just bad, and they would throw like empty cans of soda at my head and stuff. And it was just it sucked. And
the
then,
teacher just let this happen.
Yeah, our teacher, that Spanish teacher was so broken. You know, she was so done with life that she like it was chaos.
Like when she was an older public school teacher.
Yep, she looked like Newman from Seinfeld. So everyone called her Newman. Like that should be they would call her Miss Newman, and she would respond to that. I mean, it was bad. And then that December, our principal made this big announcement that there no more gambling was allowed in the hallways.
I didn't. Was there gambling?
Yeah, people like played dice in the hallways and stuff.
Oh
and,
my god!
And
what kind of fucking high school
is this? It was crazy. And we
Active dice games.
There were active dice games. There were like the Asian.
Like, come on, seven.
The Asian kids would have breakdance competitions in between classes,
like in the hallway.
In the hallway, and I actually started doing this thing. It's like I do it on stage sometimes too. I got really good at making it look like I was about to start breakdancing. Because actually, I was just trying to get through the hallway, right? But I would get in the middle of this like big circle, and it would be like my turn, and I would start like moving around to the music, and like you know, pumping my shirt and making it look like I was about to, and I would just do it until they realized I was never gonna start break. And I would go for like 2 minutes without actually doing any dance before they like pushed me out of the circle.
God.
But anyway, but back to the story. So our principal, she instituted this no gambling policy, and I saw an opportunity, and I went up to these kids in the back of my class, and I was like, you know, I can teach you a gambling game that you'll never get in trouble for playing if you just stop choking me, right?
And was that clear? There was a negotiation.
Like, yeah, it was a clear negotiation, and they thought about it, and the next day I taught them how to play dreidel for money.
Stop it.
I swear. Yeah. And so for like a good month outside my Spanish class, you would walk by and just see these black kids in like Avirex jackets huddled over a top. Yeah, just like, yo, that's a W, motherfucker. Pay up.
That's episode 142, and it's available without ads if you have any WTF Plus subscription. Go to the link in the episode description to sign up, or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And just a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Cat angels everywhere.